This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
Britain's Margaret Thatcher in Moscow on All Things Considered. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Robert Siegel.
If that introduction to All Things Considered sounds both familiar but different, it's because it was recorded 30 years ago on the day Robert Siegel became a host of the program. On January 5th, he's retiring from NPR. So I asked him to come talk with us about a subject he doesn't typically talk about on All Things Considered, himself. His career at NPR dates way back to 1976 when he worked as a newscaster. He became an editor a year later. In 1979, he opened NPR's London Bureau. He spent the next 4 years reporting from around Europe and serving as the Bureau's senior editor. Then he returned to Washington to direct NPR's News and Information Department. Robert, thank you for coming to Fresh Air. Thank you for all the great work you've done at NPR over the years and for helping to make NPR what it is today. So I want to start by listening back to your very first newscast on NPR in 1976. I believe this was your very first. It was Christmas Day. Were you filling in for someone?
I was filling in for Diane Diamond, who had not yet arrived on the job.
And was this your first newscast?
At NPR?
Mm-hmm.
I guess so. I'm terrified of hearing this, so I don't know.
Well, hold on.
it's painful, yeah.
Okay, so hold on. We're going to start with the old original All Things Considered theme.
Oh, my gosh.
Which everyone will enjoy, and it will lead right into the
newscast. Stunning orchestration, yes.
So here we go. Robert Siegel's first, I think, newscast. That's what the archive told us, that this was your first.
Oh, gosh.
First, the news and Bob Siegel.
World leaders marked this Christmas Day with public messages and private gatherings. President Ford and his family in Vail, Colorado, opened presents and dined on roast turkey. The Carters visited Ms. Lillian Carter, the president-elect's mother, who was hospitalized last Wednesday for treatment of arthritic discomfort.
I'll talk. I'll tell you anything. You can. I'll give you all my secrets if you'll only stop playing them.
Well, let's start with Bob Siegel. You were introduced as Bob Siegel. How long were you Bob on the air?
I was Bob on the air from sometime in the 1970s in New York until the first day of the Panama Canal Treaty debates in the U.S. Senate. I grew up always being called Robert. In my family, I was always Robert or Rob. But at some point, I guess in high school, I had a choice to make, which was, every time everyone called me Bob, would I say, no, please call me Robert? And I didn't do that. So I succumbed to peer pressure and became Bob. When we began the Panama Canal Treaty debates, Linda Wertheimer sitting perched over the Senate floor, and I was back at NPR in the studio to cover for all the quorum calls and breaks, I realized that I would say my name now before more people than had ever heard me say my name before. And I was either going to reclaim my name or not. So since that moment, I've been Robert again.
And you owe it all to the Panama Canal here.
I do. I owe it to the U.S. Senate and Panama Canal, yes.
Now, I read that when you were at a local station, WGLI in Babylon, Long Island, that you were Bob Charles.
I was.
Was Charles your middle name?
Charles is my middle name, and it wasn't the program director. It was someone else, some other official told me that they didn't like to have names that might offend anyone. And so I shouldn't be Siegel. And I leapt at the possibility of anonymity, that I would have deniability about this job that I'd taken. So I was Bob Charles, I guess, for about 6 months or more.
I think like a gazillion people in radio have used their first name and second name, with their second name as their last name. You know, their
Absolutely.
Middle name becoming their last name because their last name was too ethnic and exactly. In one way or another.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So what did you hear different in that first newscast from how you sound now?
I heard a young man wanting to sound older and authoritative. I heard somebody, I wouldn't have thought that I was very nervous doing what I was doing at that time, but listening to it, I hear someone who's very tight and very unnatural. And very nasal.
You know, it took me...
And it's no fun listening to it.
It took me, I think, until I was middle-aged to realize I didn't have to try to sound older anymore.
Exactly.
I was used to being, like, so young that people would think, like, really, they let you do this?
Yeah.
They're allowing you to interview me?
Right. There's some turning point when it no longer is bothersome to be thought young.
Exactly.
And usually it's too late by that point.
So did you want to have like a radio voice? And did you think you had one?
Well, I knew that I didn't have one like Bob Edwards, who was hosting All Things Considered in those days. But yes, I wanted to sound like somebody on the radio. I think that the speech, the way that I spoke when I was reading or announcing is what I was doing there, was completely unlike the way I would have asked someone a question. I mean, imagine asking someone a question in an interview in that tone of voice, you know.
So before you joined NPR, mm-hmm. you worked at the Columbia University station WKCR.
Yes.
And this was the time of the student anti-war protests. So students were taking over administration buildings, the police were on campus, all hell was breaking loose. What was it like to be a student reporter at that time when the students were taking sides, but you were there being the reporter?
It was very satisfying and life-changing. I was co-producing and anchoring our coverage of this these strikes in which several buildings, academic buildings, were occupied. And I realized during that time that, first, I liked being really well informed and knowing what people in positions of authority on either side were saying. I liked not being a participant. I liked not being an activist, because I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't been on the radio. And I really liked people telling me and my colleagues on WKCR that we had performed a real service for them, because it was a very confusing time and we'd sorted out various rumors and got straight things that were pretty garbled. And I was bitten. I was completely taken with this role, and I remember thinking, wow, if you could actually do this as a real job, this would be the most terrific job you could have.
So, Robert, why have you decided to retire?
Well, I decided about 3 years ago that I would be turning 70 this year, and that I had made a decision that I didn't want to stretch this into being 80 years old. I feel that I think I do get a lot about American politics and global politics. I can't say that I get our popular culture as well as I did 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I didn't want to get into a kind of a post-career of reflecting back on what I used to do. I'd rather that whatever I do be fresh and that I should enjoy this part of my life as something different.
So you said you're looking forward to a new part of life. Do you know what you want in that new part?
No, I don't. I don't really know what I want. I'm enjoying, you know, the past 6 months I've been sort of half on, half off. And I've tasted life without deadlines and a reading list that has nothing to do with what's new and whom I might interview next. As I like to say, I'm looking forward to having the time to accept the invitations that I'll no longer receive and to read all the books that publishers won't send me free anymore.
What did retirement mean to you when you were much younger? What was your vision of retirement?
I think I only began to think seriously about what happens after I stop working sometime when I was in my 60s or when I stopped hosting. I had this fabulous job that I loved doing and that dominated my... not only my work day, but it left me with a lot of homework to do. And so I don't think I thought about it at all. Just, you know, a few years ago, I started thinking about this and felt that I don't want sort of the last chapter of my life to be determined by disability or by lack of choice. I'm a happily married, father of two, grandfather of two, and I'm still very curious about the world, and I guess I'll do something related to journalism in the future. But the reason that I'm improvising so is that I really hadn't thought about it. You know, I recently interviewed a woman who wrote a book about the movie The Graduate, and which I remember going to see with a girlfriend in, I think it must have been December of 67, when I was in college. And the Dustin Hoffman character, Benjamin, is just out of college, and everyone's asking him, so what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And someone famously says, you know, you should do plastics. And I felt that 50 years later, I'm reliving that experience. That is, as I'm looking at retirement, everyone's asking me, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And they don't say plastic. They'll say podcast instead of plastic. It's a similar word, but that's usually what they suggest. And I don't know. I'm just sort of relishing the lack of direction in my professional life right now.
Robert, I wish you like a great retirement. I suspect it's not really going to be a full retirement. I'm sure you're going to have some kind of project.
Well,
in broadcasting or print, I'm not expecting you to be idle. But I hope you can do it all on your own terms, and that whatever it is you decide to do, both in terms of pleasure and work, that you find like a great balance of it, and that it's all really fulfilling. I also want to thank you for hosting for so long, and for being so great on the air, but also for everything that you did for NPR and all the positions that you had, because I really think NPR wouldn't be the place that it's become without you helping it become that. And on a more personal note, I thank you for making Fresh Air a national show, because that was, at NPR, that was really your call more than anyone else's. And so I personally owe you a lot for that as well. So
that's very kind of you, and you're more than welcome for all those things. And you asked earlier about how I've learned, or as to how I learned to fill the day without working. I have 1 hour covered, so long as you don't retire.
I'm not going anywhere as yet.
All right, good. Good.
All right. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you, Terry.
Robert Siegel is retiring from NPR January 5th. He joined NPR in 1976 and has been a host of All Things Considered for the past 30 years. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker tells us what's on his top 10 list, and we'll talk about the new documentary, Quest. It's a portrait of the Raineys, a family in a poor and working class African-American neighborhood in North Philadelphia. We'll talk with Christopher Quest Rainey and filmmaker Jonathan Olszewski. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Rock critic Ken Tucker has his annual list of his favorite music, along with some thoughts about a number of rock, pop, and country stars who died this year. Let's begin with music from Ken's number one pick, Kendrick Lamar's album, Damn.
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA. Quarter piece, got war and peace inside my DNA. I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. I got hustle, though ambition flow inside my DNA. I was born like this, and sworn like this, immaculate conception. I transform like this, perform like this, which yells you a new weapon. I don't contemplate, I meditate, then off your head. This that put the kids to bed, this that I got realness. I just...
No collection of songs this year cohered to form a better picture of our collective mood than Kendrick Lamar's album, Damn. The rapper talks about feeling put upon and abandoned, besieged and misunderstood, loved and hated. He samples voices from the Fox News Channel. On the cut called Lust, he has a line about waking up, hoping the election wasn't true. His distinctive delivery is characterized by a flurry of syllables enunciated with hammering force. No matter how many times I hear it, it's thrilling.
If I didn't ride blade on curve, would you still
love me?
If I'm in my mind at work, would you still
love me?
Keep it 100, I'd rather you trust me than to
love me.
Keep it a whole 100, don't got you, I got nothing. Hey, I got something,
hey.
Hold up. We gon' function,
hey.
No assumption,
no assumption.
Hey.
I'm with it. Knock it out twice, I'm with it. Only for the night, I'm kidding. Only for life, yeah, only for life, yeah, only for life, let's get it. Hit that shoulder lean, I know what's coming over me. Backstroke oversee, I know what you need. Already on 10, all money come in, all feeling go out, this feeling don't drought, this party won't end.
My top 10 music list is a mixture of albums, one song, and a book. I enjoyed the sonic experiments of rapper Vince Staples' album Big Fish Theory. I reveled in the grand pop statements of Lana Del Rey's Lust for Life and Kesha's Rainbow. I love the country music revisionism of Angelina Presley's Wrangled and Margot Price's All American Made. I laughed at the rowdy rock and roll of Low Cut Connie's Dirty Pictures Part 1 and the Menzingers' After the Party. And I was mightily impressed by the honesty and wit of Loudon Wainwright III's autobiography, Liner Notes. The song of the year? I think it has to be something overwhelmingly popular and clever and catchy, all of which describes Cardi B's Bodak Yellow, with its truculent vocal and its ticking time bomb rhythm.
Say, Lou, you can f*** with me if you wanted to. These expensive, these is red bottoms, these is bloody shoes. Hit the store, I can get them both, I don't want to choose. And I'm quick, cutting off, so don't get comfortable. Look, I don't dance now, I make money move. Say, I don't gotta dance, I make money move. If I see you now and speak, that means I don't with you. I'm a boss, you a worker, I make bloody moves. Now she say, see.
This was a year that saw the deaths of some of the most admired stars, including rock and roll pioneers Chuck Berry and Fats Domino, country artists Mel Tillis and Don Williams, pop stars Glenn Campbell and David Cassidy. Two of the most distinctive silenced voices belong to Tom Petty and Walter Becker from Steely Dan. Becker's collaboration with Donald Fagen was close, airtight. It's difficult to know who contributed what to any classic Steely Dan composition. But one thing that's ringingly clear is the tone of Becker's guitar playing, a unique mixture of rock and jazz phrasing. Listen to a chunk of Becker's solo on Black Friday from the 1975 album Katie Lied. I think the force of Tom Petty's death took a lot of people by surprise, including me. He was no revolutionary trailblazer. His themes were reliable ones about heartache and despair. His Gainesville twang owed a lot to Bob Dylan and Roger McGuinn. But holy cow, did Petty ever rack up a thick pile of great hits. Listen to an album like 1979's Damn the Torpedoes, and even the songs that weren't released as singles sound like hits. Torpedoes contains my favorite Tom Petty performance on Here Comes My Girl. I love the way it starts off with him talking, then yowling with strangled yearning, and then there's just full-throated crooning. For me, this 38-year-old song holds out a promise of desire and comfort that I needed to hear this year.
You know, sometimes I don't know why, but this old town just seems so hopeless. I ain't really sure, but it seems I remember the good times with just a little bit more in focus. But when she puts her arms around me, I can somehow rise above it. Yeah, man, when I got that little girl standing right by my side, you know, I can tell the whole wide world that shit.
Yeah, she looks so right. as myself while done it. It just seemed so useless to have to work so hard and nothing ever really seemed to come from it. And then she looks me in the eye and says, we don't last forever.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. The new documentary, Quest, is a portrait of the Rainey family in North Philadelphia. The home hip-hop recording studio was the first thing that interested my guest Jonathan Olszewski in documenting the life of my other guest, Christopher Rainey, or Quest, as he's known in the neighborhood. Quest Studio is partly for kids in the neighborhood and adults who come in and record their raps in a safe space. Quest, his wife Christina, who's known as Ma Quest, and their teenage daughter Patricia, who's called PJ, live in a working-class and poor African-American section of North Philadelphia, not far from our radio studio. Once Olszewski started hanging out with Quest, he realized that Quest and his family could be the subject of a great feature-length documentary. So for nearly 10 years, Olszewski filmed the family's day-to-day life. That film is finally completed. It debuted this year at Sundance and has won prizes at several festivals. It's opened in a few cities, including Philadelphia, and will soon be opening in more. Watching the film, it's clear the Raineys get a lot of respect in the neighborhood. During the course of the film, we see Quest and Christina get married, we see Quest in his studio, which is not a money-making enterprise, and we watch him doing his pay job delivering newspapers. His wife, during the course of the film, worked at a homeless shelter. We see 8-year-old PJ grow up, and we watch the whole family try to recover from a traumatic turn of events after PJ is hit by a stray bullet that takes out her eye. Here's Quest in a clip from the film.
When I see my child bleeding from her face, screaming, "Daddy, I'm sorry for getting shot," what do you say to that?
It's crazy. I hear these shots every day. Every day I go out there. Just to make sure ain't nobody I know. I never thought I'd go out there for my child. It's like I just watched my life, my daughter's life change instantly, and probably maybe 2 more steps closer, she could have been dead. Probably 1/2 inch closer. It could have penetrated the back of her skull.
We'll talk about that shooting a little later. Quest, Jonathan Olszewski, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you both here. Jonathan, I want to start with you. You met the Raineys through one of your students who was Quest's brother.
Correct.
Have that right? So what was it about the Raineys that made you think that they were worthy of a film and that the film would be worthy of following them around for nearly 10 years?
Well, I think it was a slow, incremental, you know, process. Quest, you know, invited me to come to the studio to take some pictures to promote, you know, their artists. And, you know, when I showed up just thinking it was going to be a one-off, you know, kind of, you know, photo shoot, I just really just was blown away by the studio. The community, the passion, just the DIY grassroots sort of vibe to the place. And I was like, this is something I want to be a part of. Any way that I can contribute, you know, to this scene, to this community, you know, I'm just happy to do. And so that led to me, you know, not just going the one day, but then continuing to sort of follow up. And this is just something, a story from North Philly that I wanted to tell, because the normal stories coming out of North Philly aren't sort of positive. And so I just sort of approached these guys like, hey, why don't we transition a little bit and make what we thought was going to be a short little documentary. So we started it in 2007, and then, you know, it ended up being something a bit different.
So Quest, I want you to describe your neighborhood in North Philadelphia.
My neighborhood in North Philadelphia is very, very beautiful. It's quaint and it's old. Like, all the buildings in North Philadelphia are like from the 1800s. Even the building I live in was built in 1893. Some of the streets still have cobblestones or red brick now. The neighbors are lovely. Like, all the older neighbors, They're so friendly when you go to talk to them, things like that. You know, every neighborhood has its problems too, so I don't want to sugarcoat and make it seem like North Philadelphia is the most beautiful place in the world, you know, to be in. But it is, like, with your eyes and physically and when you meet people. We have gardens, you know, playgrounds like everyone else does. The kids come out. We have these fabulous block parties in Philadelphia. If you have never been to a Philadelphia block party, that is the thing to do. I'm part of the hip-hop scene, so to speak, so all the kids really, you know, I see all the kids relating, and when they come together, it's really, you know, different, because you see all the different schools in our neighborhoods, and kids come from so many different places, and we like to play basketball in North Philadelphia. It's a lot of basketball courts down there, so that's where the kids kind of hang out at, and they can conversate, and, you know, they rap and stuff like that. North Philadelphia is just beautiful. I can't say enough about North Philadelphia.
And I'll say North Philadelphia also, from the outside, mm-hmm. has a reputation for being, like, a lot of violence,
yeah.
dangerous.
Right. That's the part that they always show. You know, I find it offensive. Every time I look on the news and turn the radio on or something, you know, when they say North Philadelphia, the first thing you hear is something bad about North Philly.
So, Quest, one of the things you're famous for in the neighborhood is that you have a recording studio in your basement, and you do something called Freestyle Friday, which I think you're still doing?
Yes, every Friday from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. I'll take 2 hours out of my day to have the kids come over for free and express themselves in my studio.
So what happens in your studio on Freestyle Friday?
People come from all over, West Philly, South Philly, North Philly. They get together, the guys, they come, and they I turn the microphones on, and I'll play random music, instrumental songs, and the guys that rap express themselves or freestyle or do poetry, and they communicate, and we talk. You know, it's not always just about rapping.
How did you end up starting a studio?
Honestly, they started closing down all the libraries, the swimming pools, everything in the neighborhood, and we started noticing the kids started hanging on the corner. And we have children ourselves that hang with these kids. So we were trying to get our kids something to do at the same time, get these kids off the corner. And my wife and I, we always were heavily into music. So we decided, hey, let's put a microphone, like a karaoke type thing, and let the kids come over and, you know, let them have fun. Because we noticed that our kids like to do that anyway. So we just told them, invite your friends. And they invited two, and they invited two, and so on, it kind of grew.
In the film, you say that the rapper you work with the most promise, somebody named Price.
Yes.
But he also has or had substance abuse problems.
Yes.
And so I want to play something you recorded with him. We asked you to bring something with you that you really like a recording that you made.
Oh.
And so you brought Rainy Days.
Yes.
Introduce it for us.
I made Rainy Days in 1998. And that song was made out of frustration. It was just an instrumental that I played on the piano, where my wife and I, we had an argument. She was still pregnant with our youngest child, Patricia. You know, we're facing a lot of issues that were kind of like driving us crazy. And I was just releasing myself in the homemade studio that I had in the house. A few years later, Price came along. We met Price about 2004. And I let Price hear some of my instrumentals. And he was really attracted to the song Rainy Days. And he decided to come up with some lyrics about our community and our neighborhood and what, you know, some things that's going on. And they really connected. It was almost like the song that I made then was made for him, the lyrics that he has now.
And Rainy is spelled like your last name,
yes.
Rainy.
Yes, I spelled it Rainy Days, like, because the Rainy was my name, and I was actually talking about myself experiencing rainy days. And I put a Z on the end of the days because, like dazed and confused, you know, so to speak. Also saying, like, myself is very confused. That's what the title kind of means.
Okay, so this is Rainy Days with music by my guest Quest, Christopher Rainy. And the lyric is written and performed by Price.
Cat Price, Rainy Days, EverQuest, it's Rainy Days, it's Rainy Days, Famo, it's Rainy Days, it's Rainy Days, North Philly, it's Rainy Days. It's like we dead when we broke and we alive when we rich. And some of us can't survive without a hit or a puff or the split or a sip or the fifth. War summers feeling sore from hunger, tricking whore mongers, 4400s fast around me. Cobras down me, stuck in the county. No parole, you die before you old, chasing the bread. We've incarcerated the dead. Tears of pain we weeping from having no freedom. For a way out of this poverty life we seeking. Memories from the family in the nursing home.
So that's Rainy Days with music by my guest, Quest, Christopher Rainy, who's the subject, along with his wife and daughter, of the new documentary, Quest, which was made by Jonathan Olszewski, who's also with us. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Christopher Rainy, who's known as Quest, and Jonathan Olszewski, who directed the new documentary film, Quest, about Quest and his family. They live in a working class and poor neighborhood in North Philadelphia. So you have a daughter who's in the film. How old is she now?
PJ is my youngest daughter. She is 18.
And she was around 8 when the film starts?
Probably younger than that.
When we first met, probably about 7.
About 7, yeah.
So while the documentary is being made, your daughter, Patricia, PJ, is shot in the eye in the afternoon in the neighborhood. Tell us what you know about what happened.
Well, what I do know is that my daughter got shot by a stray bullet by, you know, guys arguing. From what the neighborhood is telling us, they were arguing over a four-wheeler that somebody stole. So, you know, these are guys out here, neighborhood, you know, the neighborhood thugs, so to speak, just, you know, in the neighborhood. They actually didn't even live in our neighborhood. They were just down there. And they got into an argument with somebody in the close by vicinity. And that's how PJ got shot with a stray bullet. She was about a block and a half away. But when, like, to tell the whole story, when I actually came home from helping my cousin do a small job, and I was in the house and I was taking a shower. My wife said she was going to run across the street and go to the store. So my wife had actually left out. My wife was in the store across the street. I'm in the shower. I hear a pow, 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 pow. I said, that was a lot of bullets. So I said, let me get out the shower and make sure my wife is okay, because I know she went to the store. So I get out the shower, and as I'm going to go to the door, I put clothes on or whatever. She's coming in the door. She's like, yeah. I was like, did you hear those shots? She's like, yeah, I was right in the store. You know, I heard them. You know, they went right by me or whatever the case may be. So not even 2 seconds later, we hear the banging on the door, bang, bang, bang. PJ's friend, Portia, she's banging on the door and she's screaming, PJ got shot. You know, I wasn't all we dressed. My wife, she had just came back from the store. We looking like ragtag. We just ran out the door. We didn't even turn around to look to see what was going on. Did we turn anything off? We just left. We just ran out. Where is she? We running for her. We turn the corner. My wife ran so fast, she ran right past me. She ran right past the block because we thinking she's at the basketball court where we originally thought she would be. By the time I got there, you know, I got on the scene. They're standing there. I run up to PJ and I grab her. I'm asking her, is she okay? And the first thing she says to me, Dad, I'm sorry for getting shot. And it kind of like messed me up, her saying that, like, how are you sorry for being shot? You know, like, you can't help that. And I'm trying to see if she's okay. And once I pull the jacket from her eye, I see she's squinting hard, but you can still see the blood pouring out. So I put the jacket back on her eye. That's when the officer pulls up. You know, I'm turning around, I'm saying, my daughter just got shot. At first, he was nonchalant, like, what's going on here? Because it was just a bunch of people standing around from his point of view. And I was like, my daughter got shot. And he was like, where? Where's what daughter? You know, who? You know, and I turned her around and I showed him. And once I showed him, it's like he instantly jumped into action. He jumped in the car. I jumped in the back of the car with PJ. You know, he drove us to the hospital, like, in a blink of an eye. I really like to give my hat to Officer Moore. I think the 22nd District, I really, you know, want to acknowledge him. You know, 17th and Montgomery Police Station. Anyway, he got my daughter to the hospital. They stabilized her, and, you know, they told us that she was going to lose her eye right then and there. And, you know, they had to remove the bullet, and so they transferred her to Children's Hospital.
Do you know anything more about who shot her? Was anybody ever identified?
Well, the neighborhood speaks. So the neighborhood said, you know, okay, we think this person did it. We think that person did it. But, you know, as far as detectives and things like that, no one ever found out who did it. The guys that were involved in it, some of those guys came to the studio.
You know, I know that there are some neighborhoods that have kind of like no snitching.
Right.
Kind of, I shouldn't say policy, but like a no snitching understanding. Like you don't name names when it comes to somebody who did something, even if you know who that person is.
Right.
Did that happen with your daughter's shooting, do you think?
No. See, I'm old school. Yeah. I'm going to be honest with you. Like, I'm really old school. Like, the reason why I started letting these kids come, because I feel as though I was the one that understood them. I was from the streets, too. I was the rough guy that carried guns and did dumb stuff back in the day, too. So I felt as though I would be able to communicate with these guys, you know, the ones that everyone was scared to talk to, the ones that nobody wouldn't approach. Those are the ones that I invite to the studio. And, you know, it was a lot of talk about, you know, we can get this person, or you want us to do something? I'm like, for what? What is that going to solve? Or who are you going to get? And nobody knows who did what. You know, it was me. Now I'm trying to keep the peace in the neighborhood. So it really, you know, it took a toll on everybody, you know. And for my wife and I just to go through this is, like, in my, you know, besides my daughter, you know, our nightmares are every day. You know, we walk around these people, and then you start hearing people when PJ was going to court over it, because they locked somebody up for the car theft, and they trying to say, do she know this person, or could this person been the one that shot her? Because these guys were two blocks down, and maybe she could have saw somebody, you know. And we even started getting little threats coming to the house where people would say, like, you guys better not go to court, or, you know, if anybody goes to court, you know, something's going to happen to you guys. And look, I made a clear post on Facebook. I'm not, or on our social media, Facebook, Instagram, all of them. We're not running from anybody. We're not hiding anything from anybody. If we knew who did it, you'd be locked up, point blank. We have no problem turning you in. You know, so after that post that I made, it pretty much died down. You know, we didn't hear anything of it. Nobody talked about it ever again, you know.
How did you deal with fear that your daughter could be hurt again? And I know you were very worried about protecting her other eye.
Yeah.
So were you afraid to have her out in the street playing basketball, walking with friends, doing anything? You can become very overprotective or very worried after something like that happens.
Yeah, we kind of did start becoming overprotective, but she kind of put a stop to that herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, PJ, like, she's a go-getter. She's not going to let anything hold her back. So when we became, you know, overprotective about things and trying to help her do things, she kind of pushed us away. I'm okay, Dad. I'm okay, Mom. I can go to school by myself. I can do this by myself. You know, but she's so independent, she doesn't care. You know, like I said, she's a go-getter. And, you know, she's going to be fine. And, you know, I think we, you know, it was tragic.
You could have lost her. Like you say in the film, if she had been like an inch away from where she was.
Mm-hmm. One step, yeah. It was a .40 caliber that hit her in the eye. And that's fairly a large bullet. And that definitely, that would have killed anybody. It would have hit them. It's like, you know, God's intent that she's still here. And we just thank him every day.
The camera, Jonathan and his camera were there for some, you know, really difficult, dramatic moments, such as when the Rainey's daughter, PJ, was shot in the eye and lost an eye. What was the relationship between you about whether, like, what and if to record during that period? Because when something tragic like that happens, that can be pretty private. You don't necessarily want to be on camera when you're in that state of upset.
Yeah. You know, I remember when I first heard that PJ had gotten shot, and I was just devastated. I was actually in an airport in South Dakota, and my wife called me. And when I got back to Philadelphia, you know, Quest had been, you know, had gotten in touch with me, and I was just like, what can I do? Just as a friend, you know, how can I support you guys? What do you need? And, you know, from talking to Quest, he was like, grab your camera and come to the hospital. We want PJ to know how strong she is. We want to try to make something good come out of this tragic situation. We don't want this to happen to any other kids. And so when I first got to the hospital, I was just happy that she was alive. She's breathing. She's still PJ. Her personality was intact. She didn't have brain damage. And kind of, you know, as a filmmaker, you kind of just go into this zone of just trying to gather the material. And, you know, kind of I think that the tragedy of kind of what happened to PJ didn't really strike me until she came home from the hospital. And, you know, you sort of see the scene play out, you know, in the film. You know, she's on the stoop and neighbors are sort of trying to give her well wishes. And it makes her feel, you know, kind of self-conscious and embarrassed. And she goes into the house. And I also became self-conscious of me having the camera in those moments. And so after she had gone into that house, I'm filming her and her response to kind of the neighbors outside. And I was just like, well, what am I doing here? What does PJ want in this moment? And
Did you ask her?
I put the camera down. I felt like I needed to, you know, just check in with her. And I put the camera down and said, PJ, do you need me to get out of here too? Do you need me to give you some space? And she's like, no, John, you're cool. I know you. And it was just like, even from PJ in that moment was like, all right, dude, get back to work. And we're doing this together. And yeah, I'll never forget it.
Did your whole understanding of what the film was going to be and what the shape of it was going to be change after the shooting?
Yeah, I was trying to make a quiet portrait of a family. So it was about daily routines and, you know, breakfast and going to school and, you know, the studio and the paper route. But just then all of a sudden, like, I wasn't trying to make a dramatic film. You know, then this really sensational moment happens, this incredibly dramatic moment happens. But I wanted to stay true to that original vision of reflecting the quiet moments of this family as a counterpoint, again, to the police tape, the sirens, the stuff that the evening news portrays. And I think, you know, wanted to kind of tell this really dramatic story, but from a different angle than everyone else was sort of telling it. And I think that also motivated wanting to spend three more years, you know, filming to really kind of not have them be defined by this crisis, but see them move through it and then hopefully have them be defined really on their own terms by their own hopes and dreams, PJ's hopes and dreams, because there's a lot more to PJ than just the kid who got shot. And I wanted the film to convey all of her layers and complexity.
She's amazing because when she still has a bandage over one eye, she's shooting hoops and sinking it.
Incredible,
it's,
yeah.
It's pretty remarkable. I mean, you don't have depth perception when you have one eye. So to be able to do that so quickly while you're still bandaged, that's something. Quest, tell us more about why you asked Jonathan to turn on the camera while you were in the hospital.
I really felt that. Like I said, my wife and I really talked about PJ's recovery, like, instantly. That was the first thing that came up, like, when we went home. And we couldn't think of a better way to get some, like, peace of mind. Because actually, it was like, okay, John, I want you to shoot this. But my intent wasn't like, okay, we're going to put it in the film. I really was like, you know what? Let's just concentrate more, like, on getting PJ together and, like, letting her, you know, see, you know, where she came from. But as the filming started coming out and we started seeing versions of it, it was almost like, okay, this is it. It made me feel empowered, you know, to see, you know, her get up and, you know, get out that bed and walk out that hospital. And when we were riding home, she'd tell me I'm getting on her nerves, you know. That empowered me, you know, to see that, you know, and to talk to her about it. As like some nights, she, when it first happened, she would just have these outbursts of, you know, about what happened to her, you know, the realization. And we would all stand around and just cry together, her, my wife, and I, you know, and because we don't know what to do, but, you know, we know how strong she is, and we know we hugged and we talked about it and we discussed, you know, like, see, this is what we was talking about filming, PJ, so you can actually see, you know, you're just going through the motions right now, but later on down the line, you're going to look back and you're going to see how strong you were, you know, and it worked for us, you know, we flipped the coin with that, so to speak, because, like, everybody wanted to bring out the cameras. Everybody wanted to talk to her. Everybody had a solution, but it was only for a sound bite. Nobody really wanted to help her, it seemed, you know, or nobody was genuine about helping her. And we knew Jonathan and his camera were more than just a camera and just somebody, you know, a director or somebody filming. He was a friend. So it was easier for us to communicate with him. Like, and to be honest with you, he was white. Okay, so by him being white and being on the outside, it was like, okay, we can talk to somebody white and get an honest opinion from him about what do you, and, you know, and he's in that, you know, field. What do you think they're going to do? What do you think people want to do with the cameras? And it was true. Like, just talking to him, like, these people wanted, like, sound bites.
I'm going to ask you to talk about that dynamic a little bit more about how, like, Jonathan's white.
Right. It's like,
so he has access to, like, the white world. So
yeah.
In general.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff he can do that we can't. You know?
Like what?
Like, he can communicate with people that we can't. Like people will take him more serious on a certain level when he talks to these people, you know, like, about the business. Like they might come out and say, listen, we want to film PJ and, you know, we want to take some sound bites, this, that. I would talk to John, like, John, you know, these guys say they want to, you know, what do you think they're going to do with it? And he's like, I don't know, use it for, you know, some internet thing or whatever, just that and the third. You know, so now I'm turning around. Okay, so what do you guys want to do with it? You know, and then no one actually had to, you know, they don't know. We just need you to sign this release and we own your story. And that's what we didn't want. You know, we didn't want a whole bunch of people coming in and just running out because there was no warmth. There was no communication. There was no honesty, you know, in everything we were saying. But, you know, Jonathan brings that to the table when we talk. You know, I'm not saying he's my only white friend, but he's my closest friend, you know. You know, that's not of my color. So when I communicate about situations like that, he's the most honest with me about those situations. We've done so much stuff together, you know, just hanging out. We like the same football team. I met his family. I met his father, you know. It's not as strange as people would think, like when people get to meet each other and, like, it's always some kind of barrier between people, you know, of different races. There's always some kind of wall there, something make you feel uncomfortable about saying certain words. But I don't feel that way when I'm around John. I don't think he feels that way when he's around us, you know?
Okay, so the North Philadelphia neighborhood that Quest lives in is an African-American neighborhood. You'd be very noticeable as a white person there.
Yeah, especially early on before it started gentrifying.
Mm-hmm. So when you started walking around with a camera and you weren't friendly with the people around, you were friendly with Quest and was with Christina, but no one else really knew you, right? So how did people respond to you?
Well, I think the thing is because I filmed so close to Quest and Ma, then when we were out in the neighborhood,
so everybody
all the neighbors knew them, and it's like, oh, that's Peter Parker, that's Quest cameraman, right. You know? And so I just, you know, became attached to the studio and attached to the family. And so, when I was filming with them.
Why are you called Peter Parker?
All right. So very early on, so Price, you know, sort of stars in the film as well. And, you know, early on when it was still a photo project, I would go to the studio. And I was trying to get interesting, cool angles. And so I'd be climbing up on the furniture, trying to get different angles. Okay. And so everybody's got a nickname, you know, over there. And so I can't just go by John. Right. And so Price just started calling me Peter Parker. And, you know, and it stuck, you know. And so the whole neighborhood, all North Philly knows me as Peter Parker. Or just they call me Pete, you know.
Yeah, they wouldn't even know his name is John, for real, until they saw the movie. Because they probably like, who is John? Like, and they just, no, that's Peter Parker right there, because that's all they knew him as. And like when the guys first met him and he was climbing on the furniture, they kind of felt rejected, because I wouldn't even let them put their feet on a table, let alone this guy standing on top of a counter just taking a great angle. You know, so, you know, it was like, okay, Quest, you must be really cool with him. And they really accepted John real fast.
Jonathan, how many years did you shoot footage for this film?
Well, so, you know, 2006 was the, started, you know, the photo project, and then 2007 started shooting video, so it's like 10 years, you know, and probably about 400 hours of footage by the end of it.
How did you know it was time to structure a film?
So I think that, you know, 8 years, you know, was just sort of one-man band, no budget. But then once the independent film world started coming in, we got some funders. So once the money started, then the clock started ticking. And so we had, you know, I was able to build a team around the film, amazing producer Sabrina Schmidt-Gordon and our editor Lindsay Utes. And so we collaborated to kind of make this thing. And, you know, then, you know, we had a limited time, you know, to make it happen, because I had to pay everybody. And then last year, Sundance Film Festival gave us a call and said, we want to premiere your film. And so all of a sudden, 10 years in, we've got 7 weeks to kind of finish it. And so that sort of those sort of external forces sort of forced our hand. But I can't think of a better time for this film to be out in the world than right now. So
because I think
how polarized we are as a country. Quest is an invitation to connect, for anybody to see themselves in the Rainey family, to connect to the North Philadelphia community. And I think that we need that to sort of combat these narratives of division and fear that keep us apart. And I think that we need to listen to each other and dialogue and not be afraid of each other. And Quest is an invitation to connect.
All right. I want to thank you both so much for talking with us, and good luck with the film.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much.
Jonathan Olszewski's new film, Quest, is about Quest and his family. It's already showing in several cities, including Philadelphia, and will open in more cities over the next few weeks.